Sports, wine, life. This is the Macko and Cause podcast.
Welcome to the Macko and Cause podcast. I'm Bob Mackowitz. Maddie had to go because he's recording Leafs lunch today.
There he is,
just walking out the door. And we thought in the spirit of Christmas, we would do an extra bonus edition, strictly Leafs talk, as our present to you. Thank you very much for listening to us over 2019. And Jonah Siegel from The Athletic has stopped by. Now, the idea is we were all going to do it together, and then Maddie got called to TSN 1050. So it's just going to be Jonas and I today talking Leafs. How you doing, bud?
I'm good. I'm kind of looking forward to 2020. 2019 has been a weird year.
Really, really weird. You know, I thought it might be a good idea to talk about your Monday notes column. But before we do that, I have a question for you. And
sure.
It's specific to your role covering the team. Mm-hmm. How long have you been following the Leafs, like as a beat guy?
See, here's what I know the year. It's whenever Paul Maurice's first year was, which is, I think, 06, 07?
Mm-hmm. I think 07.
But I really don't want to become one of these media people who's like, I've covered the team for 20 years. Like,
yeah.
I just don't want to get trapped in, I don't know, that world of, like...
Well, you could just
I'm just, like, an observer to this. I hate when media members make themselves...
Part of the story?
Part of the story,
yeah.
Or, like... Anyway, so right around then.
So 2019 has been weird, and we'll get into the weekend's games. And this is actually being recorded before the Carolina game, so hopefully nothing happens that's bananas that we're going to just skip over entirely.
Jake Gardner's return,
which is huge.
Sure.
I want to talk to you about 2019 because you have some historical perspective, and a lot of things happened, and it's been a weird season so far.
Mm-hmm.
And it really feels like it's just been a weird calendar year. How would you compare the team? Whether it's covering it or the way they treat each other or even just the vibe down at the rink. How would you compare this year to other years?
I think it's different because the expectations. I think expectations change things for a team, especially a young team. Like you can feel that there's a pressure now that they have when it's expected that you're not just going to make the playoffs, but you're potentially going to win a cup. I think playing in Toronto... is hard, but maybe not for the reasons we think it is. I think we think playing in Toronto is hard because there's a lot of media. The media, like, really isn't that hard. Like, in terms of, it's not like Philly, it's not like Montreal. Like, there's not a lot of scalpels out for the players. There's just a lot of people. I think why it's hard is I think it's so, you're constantly in, under the microscope, like, every day. Like, you just don't get you don't get a breath. And I think over time, that's hard. And I think when you're 21, 22, 19, like some of these guys who came in, Matthews, Marner, Nylander, I think that's a lot. And I think I forget that. I think we forget it, that it can be difficult playing in this market with expectations, with that microscope day to day to day to day to day. Like, I think it's more of a grind than a lot of other markets.
It's an ultra marathon as opposed to really intense wind sprints.
Yeah, like, well, like, you know, like me, same, anybody in their job, some days you come to your job and you're just not feeling it. Like, you're
yeah.
in a bad mood, you're tired, like, you have problems at home, or like, the sky is gray and you just don't feel that great. But we're not being watched. Well, I guess, like, we are being watched to a different degree. I mean, just as media people. But, like, imagine, like, you went to your work and, like, 20,000 people more, like, just in the building are watching your performance. And then criticizing you for it. Like, I just think it can be a lot.
When I was on the air with Matt, I would see that we had good months and bad months. And it's not like the bad months were terrible. And I'm not sure everybody would even have noticed. Although if you actually sat there and analyzed it,
yeah.
you'd be like, oh, this was better last month.
Sure.
We would feel it because we were in the middle of it. But I guess your point is that with that amount of media following the team, everybody notices that because it's pointed out to them all the time.
Yes. And so you can't just go through a week where you're just not playing well because you're not feeling it. Like, I think Nylander is a good example. Like, Sheldon Keefe brought up after the game that he had a meeting with Nylander before the game in New York. And Nylander said, like, during the Western road trip, he just wasn't feeling great.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that makes sense. Like, there are weeks when I don't feel great. But there's not 20 people asking me, like, what's going on? Like, what was with that story? Like, why did you leave the story that way? Where were the quotes? Like, why didn't you have any information on this? I just think I sometimes forget that and need to remind myself of that these are just, like, people just like you and me some days they're shitty at their jobs, some days they're great at their jobs. And like even – or Matthews, you know, he goes a couple games and he's not playing as well. And like it happens. Like they're not going to be superstars 82 games a year. Now, do you want more consistency from your top players? For sure.
And consistency actually is an underrated word because what distinguishes like good pros from people who are borderline is exactly that. It's consistency.
Sure.
Everybody who is in a professional league is a great athlete. An elite athlete with an enormous set of skills that the average person could barely wrap their brain around.
Yeah.
And we say this all the time. You see this with basketball. It's like, oh, if he could just hit his shot regularly, that guy would be a really great player. But the reason he's not a great player is because he can't hit his shot consistently.
Yeah.
The really good ones do.
Yeah.
And so I actually feel like one of the great things about the analytics movement is it's begged us to stop analyzing short bursts of information and to look at the whole picture. And the whole picture might be a month, it might be 4 months, but in the end, all that matters is what was your mean? What was the mean that you either regressed to or rose to based on where you are in the cycle?
Yeah.
But your point about playing in Toronto is life doesn't work that way. You write columns. What do you write, like 3 a week?
Yeah, 3 to 5, something like that.
Yeah, right? Like that's a lot of content.
Sure.
You got to have 5 interesting things to say a week. Well, there might not be 5 changes in a week, though.
Sure, and I don't want to... I want to be fair. I don't want to overreact to anything. And yet, I still have to like cover the team, and you kind of have to look in small sample sizes and bigger sample sizes if you can. To bring it back to Nylander, he's a good example. He had about 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks. He just wasn't going. And so what is that? Like, is that what we think of William Nylander, where there's like inconsistencies to his effort, inconsistencies to his focus, to his drive? Is that him not feeling great physically? Like maybe his legs just aren't feeling great a couple nights in a row? Is it all of the above? Like it's hard. Like it's hard to find a proper line, I think, sometimes covering a team between covering the team and like acknowledging reality of human beings and life and I don't know. I hope this isn't too deep.
It's fine. It's just one of the reasons why I wanted to start with this question is because I believe, like, you're absolutely one of my favorite sports writers and my friend, right? So, like, I don't want people to think, you know, I'm bullshitting here, right? But one of the reasons why I became friends is because I admired your work so much, and you were such a young guy, and you had your head screwed on right. So even from the day you walked in at TSN 1050, I was kind of like, this guy's really interesting, and I would love to talk to him more. And watch his skill set grow, which it has, and I think is continuing to grow. But the need for content is killing teams, right? In the spotlight. And I think what we had here this
year... Is that true, or I'm not sure that it's any different now than it was before.
No, I think it is because of omnipresence. Like, you literally, like, you know... Like,
yeah, but what's the difference?
Did Mike Babcock really know what people were saying about him? I think this was... I think it was defined by Kawhi Leonard at the end of the season when he did his mic drop on the stage after, and he did the ha, 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 yeah, which was just his sort of way of saying, I heard everything.
Yeah, of course
I heard everything.
They just say that.
Of course they do.
But I don't think it's different. I think it's the same. I mean, 10 years ago, you had 3 or 4 reporters from the Star and the Sun covering each game. You had 2 people from the Globe. There are less now. Like, media has changed. There's more need for, like, constant stuff because of the internet. But I think that the amount of coverage is probably the same or maybe even a little... Well, maybe it's the same because you have, like, blogs and you have fans. And,
yeah.
Like, you have, social media has completely changed a lot of things.
So let me throw this at you. Is it possible, like, what's better? Is it better to have a team of veterans who know how to block it out? Or is it better, like, for young guys to learn how to own it? One of the things that's interesting about this Leafs team is that you've got guys who represent a new way of being an NHL star.
Sure.
You know, they don't resemble the Stars of 10 and 20 years ago. They don't even resemble the Stars of 5, 7 years ago.
Yeah.
They're different. And it's not hard to see that the rise of Instagram and Twitter, like, this is a steep learning curve that really came out of nowhere. And the NBA is magnificent at this. Those stars know how not to be crushed by the narrative because they know how to control it. And this is so hard for the NHL to do because their instinct is still, like, get a team of Ron Hainsey's. guys who just know how to go and put on their skates and go home to their families and, you know, show up at work the next day. Mm-hmm. It's not realistic for a 21-year-old superstar who's making $11 million a year. So, like, and you saw this a little bit with Marner and Matthews, and I wonder to what team the extent the team's comfortable with it, because they look more like they want to own their narrative as opposed to avoid it. And that's different.
Well, I think that when you bring it back to social media and owning the narrative, I see kind of two different players or personalities. I mean, I was talking to Matthews last week, and he brought up social media and how when he's not playing well, he really has to work hard to avoid it because it's just a stream of negativity.
Right.
And I can see with Marner that something is different after everything that happened with the contract. And I think social media probably had a lot to do with it. I think he feels under siege, maybe, or like a little bit, there's a little bitterness there that you can understand being a human being where people are attacking you and they're attacking your family. And I think that's probably has a lot to do with social media. Like he doesn't look to me like someone who is like loving this right now. And right. I think that's still the after effects of the contract dispute. So that's tied to social media. That's tied to our era. Like maybe it would be different 10 years ago. There's no Twitter and he doesn't see what some fans, like a small segment of fans are saying about him.
And it goes to your earlier point. When I first asked you about what feels different about this team versus all the other ones that you've covered, you localized expectations. Like that was what you really zeroed in on. Mm-hmm. And that's the point you're kind of making now, right? Is it's easy to love Marner when he's drafted fourth and he's exciting and it's all promise and the road is stretched out before him. And all of a sudden he's putting in like 80, 90 point seasons. And you're like, sweet Jesus, this guy's going to be a hell of a player. Mm-hmm. Then the contract negotiation comes, right? And the expectations change. You're not the guy who's going to do so good for me down the road. You're not the pleasant surprise.
Well, you're just defined by your contract.
That's it. And in a cap world, how do you avoid that? Because you are a number, and a number has to have a certain value assigned to it.
Sure, but I think what's been unfair to players is the way it's portrayed is if the team is not getting a win, the player's at fault. And the player's job is not to get the team a bargain contract. Like if you're the player and you negotiate a contract where within a year we're looking at it and we're saying, man, that's a great deal for the team. That's shitty for the player. That's not great for the player. Like, yes, they're making tons of money. But if you're David Pastrnak or you're Nikita Kucherov and you look at your contract and you look at your production and then you look at what's been gotten after you, that's you've gotten a deal that's below market value. That's not what you want. So why is it unfair for the player to want to get a deal that he thinks is market value and the team obviously wants below market? And when a player pushes for closer to market, he gets completely crushed.
In fairness, though, to the fan, it's not bullshit because we see with the backup goaltending situation,
yeah, but
right? Like the money was not on the table.
But it's
and
not,
also the negotiation was so open-ended that Dubas sure. couldn't even make decisions early enough. Like I heard you and Myrtle talking about maybe James Reimer would have been a good ad for the Leafs. But how do they make that deal not knowing what their cap situation is going to be? And they used it, the Marner camp, as leverage, that unknowing, like that was an asset that they had to try and get a deal done faster and more on their terms. So it's not bullshit for a fan to look at it and say, you used the cap as your leverage and...
I guess I'm saying the treatment of the players is a little bit bullshit. It's not fair to the player.
I think it's totally fair.
Well, yeah, but it's not, to be fair, it's not Mitch Marner's job to construct a team under the cap. It's not Mitch Marner's fault that they signed Patrick Marleau to a 3-year deal and then had to give up a first-round pick. It's not his fault that they had these problems on defense, that they had to trade another pick to get Muzzin, or that they had to let Gardner go. Like, he's not responsible for any of that.
That is, you're 100%
and like,
right.
And if I'm Mitch Marner, I'm thinking, like, I shouldn't have to take this under-market deal. And you can argue whether it's under-market, for sure. But I shouldn't have to do that just because I'm not sure that the team is – like, how do I know that the team is going to make right decisions? You see all these guys who take bargain contracts, and then the team does stupid shit. And then if I'm the player, I'm thinking, like, man, I just took a bargain – like, I took below-market so the team would have more flexibility, and then they went and they screwed it up. Like, what – I don't think this is – I think because of the way sports is structured, we because fans, like, they're on their team side, and under, of course. But because of that, it gets slanted against the player unfairly. And
but in fairness, though, like, you are with the players day in and day out, and you have a much more personal relationship with those guys than like almost anybody in the city would, though. Like, I mean, you said I talked to Matthews last week about this. The average fan can't do that.
True.
Even the super fan can't do that.
Yeah.
Like, people, like, their lives don't matter to the fans. Like, frankly, like, you're right. Everything you said is 100% true. But the fan is also right when they say that Marner contract kept the goaltending situation from being better.
Well, then my counter is
they're right.
Then management should have tried to sign him more aggressively earlier.
But were they willing to be signed? You would know more.
Yes.
I mean, the
indicator.
But also, like, if you were to throw out, like, how much earlier? Like, a year earlier?
Yeah.
Well, that's a big risk to take as well. Because
no, it's not. No, it was very, very, very clear. And this is, like, one of the bigger mistakes of the
Dubas has made.
Dubas, Shanahan, whatever. Right. Was not, like, it was very, very, very apparent that the longer you waited on those deals, the more that their value was going to go up and the bigger the contract was going to get. I asked Kyle Dubas before the season, like, I think, I can't remember if it was the day of the opener or the day, whenever, before last year, I said, there is risk in, like, what is the, I can't remember how I phrased the question, but basically it was, why aren't you pushing to get this done, basically, because there's a lot of risk. If these guys come out and have great seasons, their price is going to go up. It was very apparent that the longer you waited, Matthews scored another 40 goals, Marner had 90 points. Like, it wasn't out of the blue that what happened last year was going to happen and their price was going to go up. That was their screw up.
That is totally fair and certainly helped by hindsight, though, because at look, I know you say it was very apparent, but we also know that in a cap world, making mistakes really hurts you for a long time.
But that's that with those.
Like, you
kind
could
of,
say PK Subban, yeah, Bergevin, like, they screwed up, they should have signed, and then he wound up signing for $9 million.
It's different with those kind of players. With the very elite high skill players, the risk is not the same. Like, the risk in signing Marner to whatever. Let's say a year ago they could have signed him for 9 by 8 or something. And you would have looked at that and you said, this guy's had like one, he had, what did he have, 69 points? But you looked at his
Jonas,
skill and you
Jonas,
said this guy is
Aaron Ekblad. That's
yeah,
a
that's,
bad contract.
That's not
and he,
the same
and people
thing.
Were talking about him being a perennial Norris candidate.
Not the same thing.
Why is it not
because
the same
we're
thing?
Talking about skilled offensive players. Like, skilled offensive players are going to deliver value, I don't know, 80% of the time. Like, that level of skill, like elite skill. I'm not talking Clayton
Did
Keller.
You know,
I'm not talking like Victor Rask. I'm talking like very elite skill. The chances of those guys not living up to that was low. Like, the low bar for Mitch Marner was probably 70 points.
See, that's what it really comes down to, is what's a realistic expectation. And I think because of the range, like, the low bar was 70 and the high bar was 90. Well,
the high bar is 100.
Sure, okay, 100, great. Well, that's kind of how the Marner camp negotiated, as though the high bar would be 100. You are getting a 100-point-a-season guy.
As they should.
Which, right, because he kind of proved that he would be that guy.
And he's proving it again now.
But at the time that you were talking about signing him to a long-term deal, a 70-point guy wouldn't have been out of the question
either.
He could have had a hot year. He could have been buoyed by Tavares. There are a lot of ifs.
If you watched, yeah, but that was before Tavares. And if you watched...
You're right, that was.
If you watched him and you watched that skill, there's... I just don't know how you could
Nikita
not...
Nikita Kucherov was the Hart Trophy winner last year.
Yeah.
And now he might be on the block.
Yeah, I hear you, but...
Right? Like, you make it sound like
I'd
it was so clear and dumb for them not to sign him.
No, I think it was.
But you know what? That's only based, I mean, partially
it's
on
not.
Hindsight.
It's what I thought at the time. Like, I just don't... I just didn't know how you didn't look at those guys and say... Those guys are like a slam dunk to be great offensive players. It's not the same as Aaron Ekblad. He's a defenseman. Defensemen take longer.
You won't use
for
my
the
Kucherov example, though, will you?
We can look at Kucherov. Like, Kucherov was 30 goals, 60 points for 2 straight years, and then he signed that bridge deal, I think,
right,
which was undervalued. And for him, a bad deal, a great deal for Steve Yzerman. I would trade for, if I was a team that needed scoring help and I looked at Nikita Kucherov, I would trade for that guy in a heartbeat. I just think in those very rarefied cases, their job is to project. If you were looking at those guys and you had watched them play, I don't know how you could not have projected that they are going to be stars.
Except for one thing, and we talked a little bit about small sample size, that they're young. They're really young at that point. You're talking about projecting off of a season or two, really.
Yeah.
And you're talking about a signing –
But I
have crippling kind of numbers.
They're not that. No, but you're thinking of them in the light of like Mike Komisarek and Nikita Zaitsev. They're not cap crippling. Like,
no, I get it, because it's actually it's much worse to overpay the middle class than it is to pay the upper class. And I agree
skill.
With you there.
Yeah, overpay
I agree
the
with
skill.
You. But this also goes back to the idea of expectations. If you take the dough, it comes with the desk. That's what they used to say in the business is, you know, I remember seeing my bosses and they'd be there at 7 p.m. at night.
Yep.
And I remember this one used to say to me all the time, I'm sticking around. It comes with the desk. So you can say that Mitch Marner may feel a little bit slighted by social media. But the fact is, like, he signed a deal that was detrimental to the overall balance of the team.
Sure.
Not to his career, but to the overall balance of the team. And there's a reason why the Leafs are partially behind the eight ball now. And goaltending is no small part of it. They couldn't address that situation.
Yeah, properly. But I can say then don't.
And he didn't start that great.
Then don't sign Cody Ceci. Let Cody Ceci walk away, get a backup goalie, and pay someone else $3 million to play on right defense. Like, you can pick apart other things that they did. It's not Mitch Marner's fault that they don't have a good backup goalie. It's not.
I think that's true.
It is collateral damage of the decisions with those contracts, with Marner, with Matthews, with Nylander. Like, it's...
In fairness, it doesn't help when a Nathan McKinnon says, you know, maybe I'll take a smaller deal because I want to win.
I'll believe that when I say that.
I agree. And I think a lot of
that's
teams...
That's very nice to say.
Yeah, I agree. And I actually think you have a better insight into this than I do. I actually think teams around the league probably hate the Leafs and probably love throwing darts at them because you've got 100%. Like really super like
especially
privileged,
when they have this young GM who like...
Right? So they probably like taking digs at the Leafs, mm-hmm. like in the way that baseball teams like taking digs at the Yankees or the Red Sox.
It is a good problem to have three really, really, really good young players.
Right.
I'll take that problem if I'm any team. And, like, that's a big part of this. Like, they walked into a situation where they had, like, these young guys same age. Anyway.
No. I get it. And it's also a new kind of a problem in that I think, like, I like Dubas. And that doesn't mean I think he's going to do everything right. Mm-hmm. But I think you grade people on the soundness of their plan. Not everything can be done the way you draw it up, but you have to ask, am I pushing in the right direction? Mm-hmm. Like Jeff Luhnow and the Houston Astros, he had a plan. He executed it. It worked. Sam Hinkie, he had a plan.
Now
he
that
executed.
Plan's
no, I get
under
it.
Some scrutiny.
Well, yeah, in fairness. And as I said it, I thought, you know, it's not without
yikes.
Yeah, exactly.
I read a book over the summer, Astro Ball, all about Houston. Obviously, that stuff never came up.
Right, of course.
Yeah. Anyway.
But I'm just speaking about like... The X's and O's of business, about how you think you can build a winner. And we know that Dubas is obsessed with baseball and things like the MVP machine and the idea that you can take okay players and turn them into good players by coaching them up. I mean, I remember interviewing him back when he was with the Sioux, and we talked to him about getting young players and what you do with them once you have them. And he said the hardest thing is to teach them how to play hockey again because they've been taught their whole lives, ring it off the glass, stay out of danger. A problem avoided is better than an opportunity created. And he said the hardest thing we have to do is to teach them it's okay to put yourself at risk if that risk can get you ahead. And you'll never win by treading water. And even with Mike Babcock, you could see how those guys would be at odds with each other. Because Babcock, like, look, I think he was unfairly maligned for a lot of things. But certainly, he was a risk aversion kind of guy.
Just got to check my parking.
Nice.
Good.
Yeah, you've been here for a while. Okay. Well,
I don't know that he was
a risk averse. That's the thing is, no, he wasn't certain.
Risk averse is.
He was risk averse to a greater degree than Sheldon Keefe and Kyle Dubas.
Yeah, fair.
But we haven't seen guys play like this. Like you and I love the NBA, and the idea that you could win with 3-point shooting in the NBA was always thought to be impossible until you built a team that had enough of it that you could actually do it. Right, and I feel like we're there with the Leafs right now. Is like we don't know if it's going to work. And I remember Kaz saying to me once on the pod, like, "When has this ever worked before?" And my answer back to him is, "When has this ever been tried before?"
That's the problem with like the knife against this. Is that the right way to phrase it? Like the attacks against it is all the other way of doing it hasn't worked for just about everyone.
Right.
Like it only works in like the you know how much like luck. Everything you need and skill to, like, just win once.
Four bounces, Jonas.
Right.
The game did not go to overtime with the Raptors in Philly because of four bounces.
Or Fred Van Fleet for 2 months, me getting to the point, and lots of Raptor fans getting to the point, thinking, like, I would rather they play Jeremy Lin right now. And then him turning into the greatest playoff shooter, one of the greatest playoff shooting performances ever, where like it just felt like he wasn't going to miss.
And
that's fucking luck to some degree.
In a hockey perspective, like what happens if Tortorella handles the goalie situation differently in game one, Blue Jackets and Tampa Bay, and it doesn't work out for them. In Tampa Bay, maybe they struggle to a win, but they get through. And then all of a sudden, Tampa's not floundering. And then you've got the Lightning in there. Maybe the Bruins don't make it through. Yep. Or maybe whatever team makes it through beats the Blues. Like, you just don't know. Like, when it's all done, you can draw a straight line through anything. But until that, like, while you're in the middle of it, you never know where the next point on the graph is going to be plotted.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, where we get tough in the big picture. I said at the beginning of the year, I don't think this is the Leafs year. I think they have a lot of talent. I also thought we underestimated the chemistry changes and the roster issues. Like, there were a lot of question marks that I think everybody shot right past because they were like, the young players are back and they're stars, but there were lots of question marks, and you don't need much to go wrong to not be the best team. But there's a lot of parity even at the top.
The thing is, like, everything that could go wrong to start the year basically did go wrong.
Last year, lots of things that could go right did.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and you have to plan for both scenarios. Like, some of this stuff was foreseeable. The backup goalie situation was foreseeable.
Yeah,
I mean, you can say, like, Michael Hutchinson was once a good goalie in the NHL. There is a very thin track record of that, and it was, like, 5 years ago. That was very foreseeable. But, like, another luck thing. They signed Michael Neuwirth to a professional
I think they thought Neuwirth would be the answer.
Yeah, and they're thinking that's going
to
be the guy.
And previous to that, they thought Garrett Sparks would be the answer because they held on to him. And the gamble was, as you projected 2 or 3 years down the road, that he'd be good enough that he could take those 25 starts and give you a decent chance to
If you looked at his AHL tracker, you'd be like, yeah, that makes some sense.
People rip Dubas for getting rid of McElhinney. But if you believe that that guy is the right guy, like you were saying earlier about, like, look at what you've got, project ahead, make the sensible decision. It doesn't mean it's going to work, but what else can you do?
I don't know how you could have projected ahead and said, I guess you could have. I just don't know how you would have projected and said, the 35-year-old career backup has a better chance of ascending than the 25-year-old who just was the AHL goalie of the year. I don't know what world like that is. Maybe we underestimated how difficult that role is, number one. We underestimated like what effect personality can have to some degree. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a great point about the difficulty of the role because, you know, I love listening to Jamie McLennan on TSN 1050 talk about the psychological challenges of goaltending. And because he was largely a backup in his career, he understands that mentality clearly, intimately. And there are two things that seem to jump out at me. One is the obvious, that you're often getting the second half of a back-to-back, and you're getting a tired team in front of you, so that's hard. And the second one is you got spot starts. Like, you got to stay sharp. You know, it's not like being a bullpen guy in baseball, where you kind of have an idea of what your week's going to look like.
Yeah.
Right? And they'll go out of their way to get guys work if they don't feel like they've had enough. Right? But hockey's a bit different. Like, you got to sit for a long time and then all of a sudden be at 100%. And I think that maybe we underestimate how hard it is to be a good backup.
Well, I'm just thinking, like, for my job, when I write a story that I don't really like or I think could have been better, and I get home at, like, 1:30 in the morning, and I'm like, man, I wish I would have done this. I wish I would have done this. Now it would just be like I have to wait 2 weeks to write another story.
Right. And then, everybody for the next 13 days talking about how shit your story was.
Yes, and so then you're the goalie, and you go into that next game, and, like, you just come off a shitty start. And stuff starts to go wrong. You're like, oh, man, it's happening again. And you don't feel good about yourself because, like, your last start was 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. You didn't play well then. Things are not going good again. And then it just feels like it snowballs. And if you're not that good to begin with.
And you feel like you're hanging on.
Yeah, it's very easy for it to get away from you. Like, I can understand. And yet, he signed up for it. Like, we can only judge him on how he performs in it. That was the role. He signed it. They signed him to it. It didn't work.
But I think we both agree that as much as we don't like the way the goaltending situation worked out, some of the things that Dubas gets blamed for were actually him making the smart decision that just didn't work.
Like what?
Well, like betting on Garrett Sparks.
Yeah, that like process you make.
Like going back a couple of years.
This process thing, like it's his philosophy. You make decisions in real time. You don't know the outcome, so you just have to make the best decision in terms of the process. Like, what is the right choice without knowing the outcome.
Do you know what I liken it to? I liken it to how you win in blackjack at the casino. Because the game is actually in, like, you're supposed to lose more times than you win. Right. That's how the casino makes money. But there are opportunities baked into the game for you to get ahead, and you have to make the most of them. And I kind of feel like being a GM is the same thing. It's like there's a million tough things that you're probably going to have a hard time getting right. But every once in a while, there's opportunities, and you have to seize them because that's where you actually get ahead. And that's like finding a guy on a PTO that works out for your team and costs you almost nothing.
Well,
you know, that's going to the KHL and bringing back an Ilya Mikheyev.
Well, or signing Justin Hall for 2 years.
Right.
And then holding on to him. The amount of times that they could have just dumped that guy, like it's tons. Like,
and I think
if you're watching that, and the coach clearly does not want to play the guy, and it doesn't look like that's going to change, there's every chance you're just like, you know what, this is never going to happen here. And yet he just kept bringing him back, and then even before Mike Babcock gets fired, Babcock comes around, starts using him more, and now he's an important piece of their team.
It's funny when you look at the defensive core, and I want to talk to you a bit more about this. Yeah, we can get into this now. It's hits and misses, right? Like, Justin Hall's a hit, I think. Tyson Barrie is a bit of a miss. Jake Muzzin and acquiring him at the deadline is a bigger hit than I think Dubas gets credit for. Like, it was kind of...
It's an imperfect hit. I wrote about this, like, I don't remember when, but it didn't totally solve what they needed, and that's...
But at the same time, though, him and Hall have quickly become the most important defensive pair.
Yeah,
and also, also him and Zaitsev in the playoffs were the most important.
We also don't know if it's going to work. Like, we don't know if this can keep up over a full season, then into the playoffs. We don't.
That's fair. But I'm more encouraged by what I see from them than I am with the idea that Riley and CeCe are going to work, or even that Riley and Barrie are going to work.
I feel like they're probably still going to have to do something.
Yeah, it feels like it. So here's the question I want to throw at you. All right. So I took a look at this, and you wrote in your Monday morning minutes about Kapanen, right, and how Kapanen was benched over the weekend. Like, not benched, but he certainly sat.
No, he was benched. Yeah. Literally benched.
No, but it's not like he missed the game. He was sat halfway through it.
Yeah. That's right? Benched, though.
Okay, fair enough. And I heard you and Myrtle talking on the pod about his article about how Kapanen is the most likely piece to actually get dealt. And the idea is that it's going to fix the back end. Who goes? Like, out of those six that they have right now, who are you replacing? I don't think it's going to be CeCe, because I don't think they're going to park him in the press box. And I don't think his trade value is all that high. He's probably better as a seventh defenseman if you did go that way. I don't think it's going to be Tyson Barrie, because I think they believe that he could probably break out at any time. And you're dealing – this administration loves talent, and Barrie has it. And it's not going to be Hall, because he's overperforming. So on that right side, who's this deal for?
I don't know. That's a good part of the question is who is the trade for? And before July 1st last year, I think it was like May or June, I looked at like all the right shooting defensemen that I thought that they could trade for. And I think the list was like 24. And there were some guys in there, like there was no chance they were going to trade for. There were some guys in there who like barely fit the fringes of like what they could use. So that's like one half of the question. Who are you trading for? And how is he upgrading your team?
That's the big question.
That's a really big question. And then it's what are you giving up? And then, I mean, we don't know what a deal would look like. Maybe the team trading player X takes back CeCe for the year. And maybe, like, I don't know. I just don't think we can look at it. If there's
I don't think
guy
the Leafs have enough cap bullets or prospects that they're willing to part with to do another Marleau-type deal where you're just sort of like, can you absorb our problem for us?
No, but like, maybe Kapanen and a prospect and a pick and CeCe. I don't know. Like, maybe that gets you something.
Possibly. But I also think we have a tendency to overvalue these players because
absolutely.
We see them at their best. Kapanen is an interesting one to me because to me he feels like a 45-point forward.
That's
even
exactly what he is.
Even in a good situation for him, I still think he's that.
Yeah, but maybe
he's not playing as many penalty kill minutes as he did.
Well, that's interesting.
And he's not really effective at being interchangeable on the wings, and they have a surplus on the right side.
Yeah, but maybe I'm a team and I'm thinking we're not as good as the Leafs up front, and we're going to put him on one of our top two lines. He's going to play a bit more.
Well, the thought is always like a Carolina.
Yeah.
Who just needs score.
Yeah, I don't know if that's going to be the team.
I don't think so either, but that was what it was always talked
about. But
maybe it's
I don't know who the team is, but I can see how you would look at Kapanen and you'd be like, yeah, think that he can be good with us. He's young. Like, he's 23. First round pick. He can score. He's really fast. He's physical. Like, I like
– he's
funny.
A good
player. Like, I last year always thought the guy that I would trade would be Kapanen.
Mm-hmm.
And now, like, even though he's not had a great year, I'm a little more – I still think he's the guy you trade between him and Johnsson, if the two are the choices. But I kind of value what he brings, and yet there are limitations on what he brings, and there are limitations on where he can play. There, like, he's kind of
– And there's also people who are nipping at his heels in the roster that can start to absorb some of the contributions that he has.
That's one of the things.
Like, we're calling for Engvall to get more time, or we're calling for Mikheyev to maybe be on the first line.
And that's good management.
And Johnsson will come back. Right, like it's easier to see Kapanen's value when Johnsson's out of the lineup, but you put him back in there, and that's just another winger you got to find time for.
Yeah, well, and that's a good job. Like, we talk about what management didn't do well. That's what they've done well. Like,
they have assets
developed. Like, one of the things Dew was told me before last year that he liked about the Raptors was how they developed players. And you looked at all these guys who just like came from the D League, like. Not even, like, highly touted. Like, Pascal Siakam.
I was going to say,
like,
including Siakam.
Was, like, a late first-round pick. I'm pretty sure they picked Poeltl before him. They did. Like, I think that was the same draft. Poeltl went ninth. But, and then Van Fleet, and they developed these guys, and now they're significant pieces. Like, Engvall's a seventh-round pick. Like, he's not supposed to be in the NHL. Like, those guys are fucking, like, sorry for swearing.
No, it's okay.
Those guys are lottery tickets. Like, they're not supposed to be here. Mikheyev is just, like, a Russian free agent you sign. And now he's an important player. They didn't develop him. They didn't They just get him, and he's like a fully made player. If you don't do those things, maybe you have to keep Kapanen. Maybe they still will keep Kapanen. Maybe you have to sign him for more. Like, it just changes your whole puzzle when you can do little things like that to improve.
It's another reason why I think this isn't the Leafs' year. Is that I think that they kind of. The asset management over the last year was to get the stars in place.
Mm-hmm.
The stars are in place now. I think they're doing player development, which will get you more stars. Like, Maddie and I on the pod were talking about Rondae Hollis-Jefferson with the Raptors.
Good one.
Right? Like, you pick him up for very little. You sign him for a very short period of time. And you rehabilitate his image so that maybe you can flip him for something. That's the genius of the two-year deal versus the one-year deal on some of these gambles, because now you're selling off a year of this guy at a low number to another team. And that's super valuable in a cap situation. You know, Justin Hall at 2 years. Like, if they did want to flip him, he's in the first year of that now, right?
Second.
Okay, so let's say for argument's sake what happened to him this year happened last year.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're selling a guy and a year at a very low number, which is super valuable. And I feel like that's, like, Nick Batan doesn't work out. Okay, so what? You try a bunch of things. You know, you try on a lot of hats and see which ones fit.
Well, and for teams that are as good as, like, the Raptors and Leafs are, the only way you can have, especially in the Leafs' case, like, the big guys making so much money, is, like, you have to hit home runs on the margins.
Right.
That's the only way it's going to work. The Raptors, like, Hollis-Jefferson, for them, like, there's no risk that. And if he hits, like, I was looking at
his numbers. Well, it could be Stanley Johnson just
as
easily.
How old do you think he is?
26?
24. And it feels like he's been around.
Yeah, it feels like, I was actually thinking 26 was on the lower end.
Like, he's still, like, he was a first-round pick.
He's like James Johnson, but not crazy.
Yeah, I love James Johnson.
I know, but
it looks like that's over. But anyway. But, like, it's just like you just take a guy, you have this amazing development system, and maybe if you can get him closer to what teams saw in him when he was drafted, maybe he becomes a player for you. Maybe he becomes a rotation player. Like Chris Boucher, like another guy, like, how the hell is Chris? When I first saw Chris Boucher play for the Raptors, I was like, oh my God, this guy is a twig. Like, he's so thin, and, like, he's still a. And now, like, you watch him, and you're like, man, they've done a good job with him. Like, he looks like he can play on the fringes of a rotation.
So, and they've gotten better at the find and develop game because, you know, Bebe didn't work out, Bruno didn't work out. But it's the same kind of thinking, which is if you can find a rough, you know, a diamond in the rough, that's how you win. How do you think the success of the Raptors in 2019 has affected the Leafs organization? I think about this all the time, not just philosophically. Because the Leafs have always been the biggest. And then all of a sudden there's 3 million people in Nathan Phillips Square. And everywhere I go, kids wear Raptors gear. Like, the percentage of Raptors gear to Leafs gear, I don't know, make up a number, but what is it now, 5-1? Like, when I go to Woodbridge and I hang out in the 905, it used to be Leafs territory.
Yeah, and probably it is for younger kids.
Yeah, I'm talking young kids. See, because you don't hang around young kids because now you're in your 30s and you don't have children.
Yeah.
But I see kids, you know, 15 and under all the time because of, you know, my daughter. And the kids love the Raptors, man. And so I wonder to what extent the Leafs started to feel the heat go up a little bit because now inside the building, like, they're still clearly number one. But also, they're better run, right? Like, Ujiri's a genius. You know, they made the move to get Nick Nurse in there. Like, they feel... The Raptors feel like the most progressive organization, certainly, you know, in the city, but in the top tier in on the continent.
But I think the Leafs have clearly looked to what they've done and tried to, like, pick out things that they can do, like we were mentioning, that development stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, even the stuff that they're doing with...
Skills?
With skills. The skills but practice. I was going to say the growlers and using that as another stop in their... development model instead of just like this backwater outpost that you just send guys who you don't have use for. Like they're actually using it as a place.
So it's not just AHL or bust.
Right. It's like it's again, like you mentioned Kyle Dubas's affinity for baseball. That's like double A and single A. Like it's just using different resources. It's the skill stuff that you mentioned, like using having skill development practices. Like why I was talking to Tavares about this after one of the games recently. Why hasn't that been done in hockey?
Honestly, it shocks me.
When you think about it, it's astounding that you look at other sports and you look at the way that they practice, and most of their practice is about fostering skills.
Could you imagine
and hockey
a baseball
players,
team?
They don't do it.
Could
it's
you imagine
insane.
A baseball team not having a hitting coach? Why is there not a shooting coach on an NHL team?
So now they have like they're really using their skill coaches, like they're really using Darryl Belfry, and they're really saying like this was what Tavares said. I haven't used any of this stuff yet, but. He mentioned, like, in the summer you really work on it and you refine it, and then the season starts, and it just kind of slips away because you don't spend any time working on it. And so for Tavares, one of the things that he told me that's helped him recently is he's been working a lot with the skating coach. And that's something that you don't do as much during the season. And you can look at him now. He looks like he's skating better. Like, in the start of the year, he looks slow. And so something as small as that, working on... I've been saving these videos from some of their skill sessions. I'm going to use it, I think, in next week's Monday column. But you watch the way that they're practicing in these skill things, and then you watch the games, and it's like they're literally just doing exactly what they're practicing. And I know that in theory that just sounds like obviously.
No, but
they're practicing what they're doing in a game. But in hockey, it doesn't. You watch hockey practices normally, and a lot of it is just like flow and just get them skating, and it's not what they're actually doing.
So. I feel like most hockey practices that I've sat through, even at a professional level, is all about sort of systems analysis. Where do you stand? You know, how do you play?
I don't think that's it. It's almost...
It's also about just get out there and
it's
skate.
It's just get out there and skate, it feels like a lot of time.
But the hockey practice was originally created as almost a punitive / restrictive thing in that coaches didn't want their guys partying too much. So if you call for a 9 a.m. skate the next day, guys know. Or punitive because your team was shit. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to bag skate, though.
Yeah.
Like, the idea that you're actually going to sit there and teach these professionals to be better professionals, you see very little of that. I think it happens in the video rooms where you start to do breakdown of stuff.
Yeah,
but it's to your point, like shooting coaches in the NBA, hitting coaches, you know, a pitching coach. There's really not an NHL equivalent.
How many
that hasn't
coaches
been.
Are there in like football? There's like an offensive line coach, there's
dude,
a wide receivers,
receivers
coach,
coach quarterbacks
coach.
Like,
there's coach. Everything coach.
But it only makes sense. Like you have goaltending coaches in the
That's
NHL,
it.
But then and so yeah. largely because most guys who coach teams don't know how to be goalies, right?
Yeah.
Like they weren't goalies, they don't know how to talk to them.
So it's not common sense until it is common sense. And like
right.
we look at analytics now in hockey and it's like, yeah, obviously you want to have the puck more. And so obviously if you have the puck more, you're going to be shooting more. And obviously in the long run, the team that has the puck more is probably going to win more games. Kind of feels like it's common sense. And yet until it becomes, until someone goes against the grain and said, this is more important, like get on base percentage in baseball. I'm like, no shit, getting on base
right.
more is good. And yet forever, it was just like, well, his average isn't really good, but getting
but
a walk
matter
is the same
you're,
as getting
you're on
a single.
Yeah, exactly.
Matter.
And what's interesting about this is then becomes the refinement of the vision. And this is where I feel like Dubas and Keefe are right now, which is like they obviously are interested in possession and they're cycling a lot more and more effectively, which is weird coming off of Mike Babcock to think, let's bring in Sheldon Keefe to start the cycle. But like they clearly are more interested in creating high probability chances for themselves and lowering high probability chances for the other team. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the refinement of the vision of possession, which is it's like possession numbers don't happen in a vacuum because there are better ways to have the puck than others. And so have the puck and then create the best opportunities for yourself when you have it. That's where I feel like this team is going.
Well, I think you think of Babcock used to talk a lot about, like, we need to get more rolling around in the offense.
Right, rolling around.
And what he seemed to, like, be thinking about with cycling was more of a heaviness to it.
Right, exactly.
And what Keith is just saying is, I don't give a shit about how heavy you are. I just want you to keep the puck. And so if we can just, like, keep hanging on to the puck for as long as possible with our skill,
a mistake will happen.
A mistake will happen and we'll score.
Thanks for listening to the Macko and Cause podcast. Remember to subscribe on iTunes or Audioboom. And if you like the podcast, leave a review. If you don't like the podcast, then maybe don't leave a review.